Welcome to Color Country Politics, where we discuss all the important political issues facing Iron County, Utah. Our guests include elected officials and community leaders in or representing Iron County.
This is episode 53, 2020 Candidate Forum, Brad Last, State House 71.
This is Color Country Politics. We're so glad that you have had a chance to join us again. We're really, really excited today. We have Brad Last, Representative Brad Last on with us, who is District 71. He is the incumbent. He's running again. And so we're thrilled, Brad, that you had time to talk with us today. Thank you for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, let's start out like we always do. Just tell us a little bit about yourself. What would you like voters to know about you?
Well, I guess I'll give a little history. I mean, I make an issue of the fact that I'm a hometowner, if you will. But my my dad came to Southern Utah in 1960. I wasn't born here. I was born while he was in medical school, but got here quickly. I was 2 years old when we got here, so much of my life has been right here in Hurricane. I went to the public schools here, enjoyed the wonderful deserted desert, if you will, back in the early days when there wasn't very many people here, and just have absolutely wonderful memories of growing up in Hurricane. When I left here, served a mission for the LDS Church, and then I went to the University of Utah, where I got a finance degree and then an MBA. And of course, the best thing about the University of Utah was that's where I met my wife. My wife is a Salt Lake girl, a Highland High School graduate, and we met there at the University of Utah, basically just because we crossed paths during one semester and just kind of noticed each other, and then we started asking friends of ours if we could make a connection somehow, and some people that we knew. Some friends of ours connected us, and so that's kind of a fun story for us. Something that people think only happens at BYU really does happen at the University of Utah. So I just want to make that clear. We spent 8 years in Salt Lake after we were married, had a couple of our children there, our two daughters, and then we moved back to St. George, or back to Hurricane rather, in 1991 when we started a business in St. George, Southern Utah Home Care and Hospice. And we did that with my father and a partner of his. And we turned that into a really nice business and expanded into Nevada and to Arizona and had about 225 employees when we sold the company. So that's been a fun part of my life to build that company. And when we sold the company, I needed another career. So that's when I went to work for Dixie State University as an advancement officer, and now I'm the vice president of advancement there. So it's been a fun career change, and I really enjoy being involved in higher education. But, you know, it's been, Southern Utah is a special place for us. All of our kids, of course, grew up here, went to the public schools here. Four of our kids have gone to Dixie and one of them to SUU. There's still one left. We've got to see what happens to him. He's starting out at Salt Lake Community College, and so we'll see where he goes from there. But that's kind of the background on my family. One interesting tidbit there that you know that people might find interesting is just in 1959, I guess the doctor that was here in Hurricane left, and the Lions Club that year took it on as a project to find a new doctor to come to town. So my dad was just finishing his medical training in Spokane, Washington, and somehow the Lions Club found him. And he grew up in Gunnison, Utah, so small town, and small town seemed to fit for him. So he came to Hurricane and immediately fell in love, and the rest is history. So that's how we ended up in Hurricane.
That's great. I love that story. Hurricane is a lot bigger now than it was in 1960.
Well, in 1960, I think the statistics are pretty close anyway. There was about 1,500 people in Hurricane, but only 12,000 people in all of Washington County. So there was about 5,000 in St. George. So, and I can certainly remember those days when there was one stoplight at Main Street and the Boulevard, I remember there was a penny store there and some other stuff. I don't know. But that was the one stoplight in St. George for a long, long time.
That's fun. I know the Hurricane Valley appears to be poised for another big population explosion. So I know there's a lot of stuff going on there commercially and residentially. So.
Yeah, well, we have the land here, and it's quite likely that at some point in time, Hurricane will be the largest in terms of population, the largest city in Washington County. So I'm going to be dead by then, but nevertheless, in my lifetime, I have seen some pretty dramatic changes.
Yeah, certainly. Well, okay, so you are the incumbent, as we have mentioned. Why are you running again? Why are you wanting to take this office on again?
Sure. Well, let me give you a little bit of history, kind of about my political career, and then explain that to you. But as I said, my dad was a doctor here in town, and as the only family doctor in a small community that served really Zion National Park and the Navajo Reservation and the polygamous communities of Hilldale and Colorado City, he was just busy all the time. But my dad was an incredible example to me of public service and the fact that we ought to give back. And with all the business that my dad had with his practice and also with his church work, he found time to be on the Hurricane City Council. Later, he ran for the school board. And then toward the end of his life, he also served on the county commission for a while. And in 1993, my dad died of cancer. He was still fairly young. He was 64 years old. And it's kind of like later that year, there was just a switch that went off in my head. And it's like, it's your turn. It's time for you to get going. And so that's the year that I decided to run for the school board in Washington County. So I served two terms on the school board, 8 years. And I learned a lot about education and, kind of fell in love with it, really. I mean, I had a degree and a master's degree from the University of Utah. Education was an important thing in our family and to me. But as I got involved in the policy issues, I recognized that there were some things that probably could be adjusted and fixed at the state level, particularly some of the funding formulas that were well-intentioned, but that were hurting Washington County and Iron County for that matter. And so I decided to run for the legislature. In part because when I approached the local legislators here about fixing the problems, I just didn't get any help. In fact, it was quite the opposite. They just said, we can't do that. And I explained to them what needed to happen, and they just said, no, I don't think you can do that. So that kind of frustrated me, and I felt like rather than being on the sidelines watching it happen, that I could get in the middle of it and really try to help do some things. So That's why I ran for the legislature initially, was because I wanted to jump in the middle of education policy. And much of my involvement in the state legislature has involved education policy. More recently, my involvement in the legislature has been about the budget. I've been had the good opportunity or the blessing of being the chair of executive appropriations for 6 of the years that I've been in the legislature, either the vice chair or the chair of executive appropriations. And that's the budget chair in the House of Representatives, and there's also one in the Senate. And, that's put me in a position to really be involved in essentially every financial decision that the state legislature makes. We are the appropriators in the state. We decide where the money goes. And early on, I had one of my legislative colleagues, Greg Curtis, tell me, there's going to be a lot of guys out there that are going to be trying to pass all kinds of bills and get involved in all kinds of controversy. But he said, let me tell you, the money is where it's at. And if you can figure out how the budget works and if you can get involved in the budget, that's where you can really have influence in the state legislature. So that's what I've done. And, I've enjoyed my time there, and it's an appointed position. The speaker appoints this position. And you have to earn the trust and appreciation and respect of your fellow legislators, your colleagues, especially the leadership team, in order to get into this kind of a position. And I talked to the speaker before this election came up, and I said, look, Brad, I don't want to be one of the old guys sitting on the back row if I'm not involved in leadership. How do you see this next, you know, this next leadership team coming together? And he just said, if I'm elected, I want you to be there. I do not want to make a change. And, you know, I would really appreciate it if you'd come back and be here with us. So that's, you know, that's part of the motivation for me running. I love it. I love the numbers. I still feel a lot of passion for the process. And I feel like I have been a really strong advocate for Southern Utah and for the principles and values that we hold dear. And that's why I want to go back. And I feel like I can continue to be an important part of the policy, important part of the fiscal policy, especially in the state. And I can help continue to direct the finances of the state in a fiscally conservative way and make sure that the taxpayers of Utah are taken care of, that we get the best return on investment for the dollars that we're spending.
That's great. I appreciate the nod to fiscal conservatism. I know there's always criticism about the budget, about taxes, about revenue, about expenses. But I do feel like in Utah, we're lucky to have such a conservative legislature, you know, despite the criticism, I guess.
Yeah.
So what are a few things that you hope to accomplish if you are reelected?
Well, just following on that same theme of fiscal conservatism, you know, I think one of the things that people don't understand is that legislators don't just go to the legislature, make policy, and then leave, and everything that they do stays in place. It is a changing, dynamic environment, and boy, if that were true last year, it's more true. I don't know if that's even a reasonable term, but we're certainly seeing how dramatically things can change.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's part of what I want to do. I want to continue that down the road of being keeping the fiscal conservative processes in place. And, you know, I feel like I need to just comment about some of the things that are floating around out there in terms of the state legislature. You know, tax policy is pretty complex. And we have this intricate system in the state of Utah of property tax and income tax and sales tax and also fees that people pay for driver's licenses and hunting licenses and things like that. And it creates this intricate system that is the budget or that are the revenues of the state. And then the legislature, of course, appropriates the money, and the governor's office basically carries out the instructions of the legislature in terms of the appropriations. Last year, the state legislature passed one of the biggest tax cuts in the history of the state. And it's interesting to me that some people continue to say that was a tax increase. And if you want to take bits and pieces of that tax package, which was a package, which was structured with the intent of accomplishing something very important and very specific for the state. You can take bits and pieces of it if you want to, but it was a package. And anyone who says that the legislature's intent was to generate more revenue so that we could spend more money is wrong. They are simply wrong. There's not one senator or one member of the House of Representatives that voted for that bill because they felt that they needed to generate more money. Wasn't true. The reason that we needed to do the tax reform package was because we had a revenue balance problem. And we have this interesting thing in the state of Utah called the Constitution. And the Constitution says that all the income tax generated in the state of Utah is going to be spent for education. And as time has gone on, the income tax has been very strong in the state. And it's because of the good people here, and also I think because of the policies of the state. We've got entrepreneurs, and we've got hardworking people. Businesses want to come here. And all of these things together just create this, you know, this amazing environment that that is Utah. So the income tax has been strong. The sales tax in the state pays for everything except education. And there's been a lot of pressure on the sales tax. We call that the general fund. A lot of pressure. And you can think of some of the reasons why. Medicaid is a good example. Medicaid has been growing, and there's nothing we can do about it. That's a federal and state partnership. And as the Medicaid population grows, we have to cover the people that are on Medicaid. And of course, voters have now voted that we need to go into full Medicaid expansion. And they increased the sales tax by 0.15%, which probably took care of the first year of the expansion. But as we continue to expand more because of the expansion, if you will, it doesn't cover it. So sales tax is under tremendous pressure. Another thing that's put a lot of pressure on the sales tax is transportation. We have a growing population in this state, and infrastructure is incredibly important. You're in the real estate industry, you know that. If people are going to move here, we have to have infrastructure for them. And the roads, many of which are a responsibility of the state, are paid for by fuel tax, and they're paid for by income tax. And many people think that the fuel tax pays for all of the roads. The fuel tax pays $600 or $700 million a year, and we take another $600 or $700 million a year out of the sales tax. So there's been tremendous pressure on the sales tax. So the reform package last year was to do essentially nothing more than to raise the sales tax so that our general fund would be bolstered and reduce our income tax. And the reduction in the income tax was $639 million based on the bill. And the increase in the sales tax, $479. Now, you and I well know what happened. The two easy components of that bill to explain, which was the tax on food, going back to the normal level of tax of everything else in the state, and a 10-cent increase in gasoline tax, those were the two things that got talked about. And the people that were sitting at the grocery stores and wherever else getting signatures, that's all they knew about. And I had many people that went to the grocery stores and were asked to give signatures, and they said, well, wait a minute, you're going to take away my income tax cut. And they looked at them like, what are you talking about? So anyway, you don't have to believe me about this. The tax experts in the state helped us put this together, and it was a carefully crafted package to make sure that almost all people in Utah got a tax cut. And there was about 85% of the people in Utah that would have received the tax cut. And that would have come in the form of, you know, income tax going from 4.95% to 4.66%. The people that would have benefited the most would have been the big families, because we were going to increase the dependent exemption from $565 to $2,500. So big families would have been huge beneficiaries. People that are on Social Security that are paying tax on Utah income would have been the beneficiaries. And then the people that everybody said they were trying to help, the poor people, maybe that's not a fair word to use. I would say the hardworking people of Utah making less than $60,000 were actually going to receive a grocery tax credit. And it didn't matter if they paid income tax or not. Even if they didn't pay income tax, they would have received this money. And it would have been far more money than they were paying on the 3% increase in the grocery tax. So anyway, you want to look at this, the facts simply do not agree that this was a tax increase. This was a package. And that package was a significant tax decrease to the taxpayers of Utah. And I will only say one other thing about that. And that is, people who are distrustful about that need to understand that at the state of Utah, we have data. The tax commission knows you, and the tax commission knows me. They know where I live. They know how many children I have. They know how much money I make. They know how much tax I pay. And when you combine that kind of information with data analytics tools, you can essentially take a person's name off of that data, and you can evaluate how the new tax policy is going to affect that person, that family. And when you do that across the entire state, you can see exactly what the impacts are going to be. And so that's what we did. And so we know that 85% of the people in the state would have had tax decrease. People like me, probably not, frankly, because we don't have children at home. I guess you're in that same situation. and we're above the thresholds where people would have received some of the benefits. So, and it's a moot issue at this point because we've gone a different path. But if I'm going to be accused of voting to raise taxes, and that's one of the major platforms of my opponent, I'm just telling you he's wrong. And you can call it a half-truth or whatever you want, but I'm giving you the facts, and the most conservative entities or the most conservative groups in the state, Libertas, the Taxpayers Association, Sutherland Institute, they all agree that it was a tax cut. Okay, so we were talking about why I'm running and what I intend to accomplish. I intend to continue to fight for conservative values. I intend to continue to work on great policies as far as our appropriations and transparency. And I feel like I'm in a really good position to do that. So there you have it.
Well, let me just ask you one follow-up question on that, because I know, as far as the tax reform package, like that ship has sailed, and the legislative session, the most recent one, not the special sessions, but the one that just ended, there was no appetite at all to even address, any kind of tax reform. I know you were just wore out.
Yeah, that's a pretty good description. It really is.
So coming up, especially given the situation that the state is in with the loss of income tax revenue, I'm assuming that there's going to be a significant shortage. Just briefly, what is that going to look like next legislative session?
Yeah. Well, first, I guess I should finish the conversation. I felt like I was rambling on about that, but there were some points that I needed to make. But as I said in the beginning, we have this constitutional provision that says all income tax needs to go to education. And so that's what we were attempting to do, is create a different balance in our revenue sources. But another solution to that, of course, is to say, well, can we spend the income tax on something else? And that's precisely what we did. We didn't see any reason to go through the referendum and not have any idea how to put a budget together, not knowing what it was going to look like. So we just decided to repeal the bill that we passed in December and go forward a different direction. And we negotiated with the education community, and basically they agreed to help support us in having a constitutional amendment on the ballot this November, so the voters of the state of Utah can vote to allow the state legislature to spend income tax on programs for children and programs for people with disabilities. That's about $850 million in the state, and given the imbalances we've had with income tax and sales tax, I think that will probably get the state through another eight, maybe 10 years before we have to have another major tax reform. But to your point now, who could have imagined where we would be right now? And if you look at the current fiscal year that we are in, our revenues are down by about $400 million in the state. And so what we have been struggling with since we left the session, thinking we had this wonderful budget put together, we've been struggling, how do we get to the end of the year? And based on conservative principles and good fiscal policy, which means we don't spend all the money that we take in, we put money in our rainy day funds, we don't go out and bond to the limit, we keep some bonding capacity in reserve, we keep our AAA bond rating in place so that if we do have to go to the bond markets, we can get the very best rates out there. Now, all of those things have put us in a pretty good position, I would say better than any other state to handle the situation that we're in. And we'll get through this fiscal year, which ends June 30, in pretty good shape. But I was on the phone this morning with our staff and my vice chair and the Senate counterparts, and we were talking about what we do now, what we do going forward. And, the estimates, there's a pretty broad range of where we're going to be in terms of lost revenue, but I would say that it's probably going to be somewhere between $800 million and $1.2 billion in the next budget year. Well, we just added, you know, several hundred million to the budget when we left the session in March. And that's all gone, frankly. All of the things that people work hard to get and that legislators evaluated and prioritized, all of those things are gone, at least very likely. And we are going to be looking now at what can we cut in the state budget in order to balance the budget, because Utah, like every other state in the nation, has a requirement that we're going to balance the budget. And that's what we have to do. So we are already looking at a system of prioritization and looking at recommendations. We will have an executive appropriations meeting on Wednesday of next week to kind of start the process. And then we will have appropriations committee meetings late in the month, and we will come back in June, and we will really have to rewrite the budget that we just put together in the past legislative session.
Yeah, that's a lot of work. I know that. Anyway, there's a lot that goes on, you know, sort of away from the cameras, that's just a lot of, you know, grinding hard work putting that stuff together. So, okay, I'm going to ask you two questions at once. First of all, what do you think the legislature is doing well, and what should be improved at the legislature should you go back?
Yeah. Well, we talked about conservative fiscal policy and conservative policy in general. One of the great things about Utah is that we don't overregulate. That's one of the reasons that it's a comfortable place for companies to come. And so I think those are things that we need to continue. But one of the things that I'm the proudest of, one of the things that I think the state legislature is doing well, and quite honestly, I have been right in the middle of these decisions and these processes, and that is the appropriations process itself. Many states have what's called a Ways and Means Committee, where a very few legislators get to sit on this committee that decides where the money goes. In Utah, we have a very different process. We have a system of sub-appropriations committees, where each individual member of the legislature gets to sit on one of these committees. And what happens is that committee will have responsibility over a certain area of the budget of the state. So public education would be a good example. They're one of the largest budgets. Social services is actually the largest budget. So that's another one. We have business economic development and labor. We have natural resources. We have executive offices and criminal justice. So everybody gets to sit on one of these committees. And quite honestly, much of the work of the legislature is done in these committees. And individuals in the legislature who care to be deeply involved in the budgeting process have that opportunity. But when I came to the legislature, what would happen was these committees would do their work, and then the budgets and the priorities would be passed up to the Executive Appropriations Committee. That's the committee that I chair now. And quite honestly, I think the Executive Appropriations Committee and leadership were making most of the decisions, despite work that was being done in the committees. Well, over the years, and again, I've been in this position for six of the years that I've served in the legislature, we have worked very hard to strengthen the role and the work of the Sub-Appropriations Committee so that every legislator really can play a more important role in the appropriations process. So, and I would say that Executive Appropriations now makes a real effort to try and follow the priorities that those committees have established. And if we deviate from those, it's with a lot of conversation and discussion with the chairs and members of those committees to understand why they made the priority decisions they did, and to perhaps give them some of our thoughts on it based on our experience in the legislature, and then kind of come to an agreement about why we think maybe things could or should be changed a little bit. So I would say one of the things that we do better than almost anybody is the appropriations process. And some other really cool things that we've done relative to that is just improving the transparency. So the fiscal analyst at the state of Utah, our fiscal analyst, our staff, we have created these tools so that every legislator and really members of the public can get into the details of every single one of these appropriations requests and see who the request came from and see what the justification for that request is. And they can, you know, I guess any member of the public could make their own judgments about whether or not that was a good thing for the legislature to do. So I think that's something that I think that the legislature does very well. And I, again, take great pride in it. As far as what can the legislature improve, one of the things that the legislature is often criticized about is just the amount of bills that we have coming through the system. And, you know, I agree with that. And we have a 45-day session. There's been some talk that maybe we ought to extend the legislative session so that we can pass more bills. And, you know, if you look at my history, you can get on the state website, you can see how many bills I run. I don't run a lot of bills, especially now because I'm so deeply involved in the budget. But I do think this is an area, and it's a policy consideration, and it involves constitutional principles that are kind of hard to manage around, because you can't really take an individual legislator right to represent his constituents or her constituents by saying you can only run so many bills. But in the past few years, we have been trying to implement some rule changes in the legislature to, I guess, discourage or at least make it more difficult for any one legislature to consume a lot of staff time with a lot of bills. And perhaps other legislators don't get to have their bills prepared and they don't get to run their bills. I've heard it said that it's kind of a crazy way to evaluate the success of a legislator when we look at the number of bills they passed. And I could not agree more. And so I think that we need to continue to work on that and find some kind of a constitutional way to limit that. I do think that the legislature, with our budgeting and all the bills, we put a tremendous amount of pressure on our staff. And I think sometimes the policy is not as good as it could be if we would just slow down, relax, come up with a new metric to evaluate the success of a legislator, and focus more on good policy, but not necessarily on a lot of policy. So that's something that I think we really could do better.
Yeah, I'm not going to disagree with that. As someone who watches bills and tracks bills, it's a lot of work for the public to track.
Well, the thing about bills, you have to understand, I guess to people that haven't been involved in the process, it sounds like every time you come up with a new bill, you're creating new laws. And it sounds like you're familiar with this, so you would know. But really what we're doing is we're tweaking aspects, or we're tweaking language that's already in the code most of the time. And sometimes you'll see a bill that only has just a few word changes, sometimes only one word. And it's not necessarily creating new policy, but it's, as time goes on, sometimes we need to change a date, or there may be something else that's changed in the state where a department needs us to change something so that we can be in sync with federal code or federal building codes or something like that. So it's not like we're creating all those new laws. It's just tweaking the laws that we have in many cases, but still it's too much. And back when I first got to the legislature, we had these big 4-inch binders sitting on top of our desk with all the paper bills in the binders. And every time somebody wanted to do an amendment, we had pages that had to run around the floor and pass us all a piece of paper that had the amendment on it. And so it kind of slowed the process down, and we couldn't do that many bills. Well, now with computer technology, we can run a lot of bills, and the staff can write a lot of bills, but that doesn't mean it's the right thing to do. And again, especially this last year with the tax reform stuff, and now this year with the COVID-19 and the budget crisis that we're in, our staff, usually they get a really nice break after the session, which kind of compensates them for all the pressure that they're under during the session. And now they're right back in it, trying to help us work our way through the challenges with the budget because of the COVID-19. And I my hat is off to our staff and the good people that work there. Let me tell you, in terms of return on investment, the taxpayers of Utah are getting their money's worth from the legislative staff right now.
Yeah, no, I've seen that, and I will second that. Hats off to all of the staff, because they do so much work and so much research and, you know, so much running around and coordinating. And I will make one thought here is, I think some of the best legislation that I've seen actually takes maybe more than one session to put together. I mean, some of the stuff is complex enough, it's complicated enough, and there's a lot of vested parties that should have input. And so sometimes I think the best legislation takes maybe two or three sessions to really get perfected and become the best legislation for the state. So,
boy, that is a good point. And I have to hand it to legislators that are patient, that are willing to, again, going back to the issue of how many bills do I get passed this year? Again, some legislators really are caught up in that. And sometimes it's just really important for them to get a bill passed. But I have watched so many good, solid statesmen and stateswomen up there who have presented ideas that didn't get a lot of attraction initially, but as they worked with other legislators and helped them understand what it is that they're trying to do and brought in staff and brought in outside experts, eventually they get to something that really is perfected. And I will say also, I've joked with a lot of people, the reason we come back every year is because we have to fix the things that we screwed up last year. And that really, to a large extent, is what happens. I mean, we're tweaking and tweaking and tweaking Utah code, Utah statute constantly. And that's much of the work that we do up here. But you bring up a really good point about patient legislators and good, solid policy.
Yeah. Well, okay, before we go, I did want to make the point that we're having this conversation not because we're really invested in Hurricane, but because District 71 actually comes up and includes Summit, Parowan, Paraguna, and Enoch.
Don't forget
and Brianhead. And Brianhead, Brianhead's going to be really cool. This doesn't have anything to do with anything except the resort is being purchased by some people who I think are going to do really, really cool things. So, Again, not a thing to do with Brad Last, but but watch out for all this cool stuff up the front.
Yeah, I look forward to seeing it.
All right, so tell us, just to kind of wrap up, what else do you want voters to know about you? And then give us your website, your Facebook page. How do people get in touch with you if they have an issue that they would like to discuss?
Sure. Well, and thank you for bringing that up as well. This is kind of an unusual district, and some people may not be familiar with that process, but every 10 years when the census information comes out, the legislature is charged with redistricting. And going back to those constitutional principles that we talked about earlier, there's a principle called one man, one vote. And basically what that means is that every person in the state should have exactly the same representation as another. And so when we divide up these districts, they have to be seriously within one or two people of each other. So when this district was, when I first started to serve in District 71, it was all in Washington County. Then in 2000, with the 2010 census, the districts were changed, and the election in 2012 was for a different seat or a different district. And that district includes now part of Iron County, and much less of Washington County. So for me personally, it has created challenges, you know, with my real job and other responsibilities and serving in the legislature, being back and forth to Salt Lake, and then serving Iron County. I've met some wonderful people, made some great relationships in Iron County, and appreciate the opportunity to serve up there, and look forward to continuing. And one of the things that I would say is that because of the nature of the district, it's critical to have strong relationships with the other legislators. So many of you will know Evan Vickers, who's the senator from Cedar City. and just an amazing individual. And he is the majority leader in the Senate. So I have the good fortune of working with him in joint leadership meetings many times throughout the year. And Rex Shipp, who now represents Cedar City and some outlying areas as the representative. And John Westwood before that, and Bud Bowman before that. You know, these were great people. And in order for me to serve effectively the people up there, I have to have good relationships with those guys. And we work extremely well together, have a great deal of respect for them. And I think that allows all of us to do our jobs better. So as far as getting in touch with me, I appreciate your comments, your input. And I always tell people that I have one phone, and my phone number, you can get on the state website and you can find it, but I'll tell you what it is. It's 435-817-0064. Because it's my only phone, I get a lot of phone calls. So if you want to send me a text message, quite often that's the best way, just so you can say, hey, this is so-and-so from Enoch. I've got an issue. Will you give me a call? And that's a good way. And I would say even during the legislative session, we're busy up there and there's stuff going on all the time, but legislators are just like teenagers. We never put these phones down. And if we get a text message, we will respond. And that's a really good way to do it. My campaign email is just district71@infowest.com. My Facebook page is Brad Last 4, the number 4, Utah House. And we're posting a lot of fun stuff on there. I encourage you to go there. And again, I just encourage people to reach out. This is a representative democracy. My job is to represent you. And if you stand on the sidelines and are critical without calling me and allowing me the opportunity to help, not sure that's fair to you, not sure that's fair to me. So let's get in this together. If you've got issues, let's get them resolved and don't be afraid to reach out.
Very good. Thank you for that. We really appreciate your time today. I know it's the off season for the legislature, except you kind of been called back in. So we appreciate your time today. So that website again is district71@infowest.com, mm-hmm. or you can go to the legislative website at le.utah.gov and send Representative Last a text. All right, Jesse, you've kind of been a sideline with this whole thing. Do you have anything else to add before we sign off?
No, I'm once again the Andy Richter to your Conan O'Brien.
Well, I have to say that I'm very impressed that, I mean, it looks like from the configuration of your home that there must be young children there. So either you've got them totally under control or something else is going on, but way to go.
It's the magic of push to talk.
Okay, there you go. Everybody has their strategy.
That's right. All right, everybody. Thanks again. Thank you. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Jenny Hendricks along with my mostly silent co-host this time, Jesse Harris. This is Color Country Politics, and we'll see you next time.
You've been listening to Color Country Politics, a production in cooperation with Utah Politico Hub and graciously sponsored by Century 21 Prestige Realty at 121 North Main Street, Cedar City. Special thanks to Amoeba Crew for use of their song Background Indie Rock, licensed under Creative Commons. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever fine podcasts are found. Also, check out our YouTube channel where we post video of our interviews. And don't forget to follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and our website at www.colorcountrypolitics.com.